Well, we're reading Exodus again, and we're coming to a pretty important part of Exodus. This chapter, we're in Exodus chapter 19, and so this chapter is maybe one of the last just easily exciting chapters before we get into some hard work. If you're trying to read through your Bible in a year, this is the part of the Bible that you often start to struggle. Maybe not chapter 19, but probably chapter 20, chapter 21. And that's because the opening chapters of the Bible are really exciting, lots of stories. But it's like God begins to hit pause on the movie here and begins giving some explanation. And instead of a story, we're reading about all these laws, and we're reading about the particulars of the construction of the tabernacle. And so it's a little bit like you're putting down a novel and you're picking up a instruction manual or a legal law code, and then you're maybe picking up a blueprint for some building. And specifically in Exodus 19 to 24, we're going to look at something called the Mosaic Covenant, and then 25 to 40 is a lot of detail about the tabernacle. And I think because it's so different, we're tempted to put it down. And yet, that's a problem, because these chapters are really the heart and soul of the book. And while it might seem slow to us, there are a number of things that highlight its importance. And one of those is that God's going to be speaking directly a lot, especially when we get to the book of Leviticus. It's like all God said. And then two, the whole book of Exodus, and some would even say Genesis, has been waiting for this moment. So this is like the climax of the stories. That, you know, if we stop here, it's almost like turning off the movie before the last scene, before the climactic scene. And so since the fall, we've been kind of wondering, how is God going to reverse the curse? And he makes this big promise to Abraham, and then talks about nation and land, and then we see how God can take evil and use it for good. But there's just a few people, and then they're all in Egypt. And then in the beginning of Exodus, God's turning Israel into a nation. He's rescuing them. And then at the very beginning of that rescue, he says, okay, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to meet you at a mountain. Let's meet at a mountain. And then we get to chapter 19, and God shows up in a big way. And we know this is important also because of how much of the first five books of the Bible are devoted to this. So you have one whole book about their time here at this mountain, and you got a major part of two other books about their time at this mountain. And so this is going to be about 11 months that they're at Mount Sinai, and there are going to be 57 chapters of the Bible devoted to these 11 months. So we've got, I don't know how many chapters, Genesis, 60 chapters to here that are devoted to like 60,000, or thousands of years, excuse me, devoted to thousands of years. And then you've got 57 chapters devoted to 11 months. So this is obviously a big deal. And how much you talk about something just in general usually shows its importance. Sometimes people are just talkers, so you don't know if it's important because they're talking for a long time, because they're just talking for a long time. But other, you know, in the Bible, if God talks about something for a long time, you know this is important. And so in Exodus 19, it's like he introduces the covenant. And we're not going to get to all the laws yet, but we're going to get ready for those laws. And I think this chapter orients us so we know why we're reading what we're reading. And we're going to begin in verses 1 to 6, where God explains the purpose of Israel. So we've got this idea from the Abrahamic covenant. Israel is for blessing the world. But how are they going to bless the world? And so Exodus 19, 1 to 6, he gives us some of the details and the setting in verses 1 through 3 to start. Isaiah, you want to start us off? Verses 1 to 3, we'll just do something different.
On the third new moon, after the people of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. They set out from Rephidim and came into the wilderness of Sinai, and then camped in the wilderness. There Israel encamped before the mountain, while Moses went up to God. The Lord called him out of the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the people of Israel.
Okay, so like we just said, this is a fulfillment of prophecy. God said, Israel's going to come to this mountain to serve him. And then you remember from last week, throughout the times that Moses was talking to Pharaoh, he kept saying, we want to go into the wilderness for 3 days to make sacrifices to God. And I think somebody even asked a question about that last week and asked, how come Moses told Pharaoh 3 days and then we're going to make sacrifices to God? And I was reading this week, actually, that it's interesting that Hebrew word for sacrifice that Moses uses there is sort of an ambiguous word, and it could mean sacrifice or this word serve, which is what God said, I want you to come to this mountain to serve me. And so what was happening, one author writes, is that Yahweh and Moses were kind of exploiting that word's ambiguity when they declared to Pharaoh that Yahweh wants Israel to go into the desert to serve him. And so Pharaoh knew what this was about. Israel was his slaves, and God is coming to Pharaoh and saying, no, I want to change the setup here. Israel is going to be my servant. And that's why Pharaoh freaked out, of course, and that's why he rescued them and brought them to this mountain. That's why they're here, to be the servant of God. He said at the beginning, he's going to bring them here to serve him. And so that's going to be an important theme as we keep reading through the Bible, like Israel as the servant of God. And that's what's beginning here. What happens to Israel in their redemption is that they are leaving the slavery to a ruthless earthly king for the status of being a servant of the King of Kings. And we were even talking with the kids this week about how you're always someone's servant. We weren't made to be our own king. And so if we try to be our own king, we always end up serving someone else. And even as free people now, we're slaves. We're slaves to the best king, God. And we see that in Israel here. But how are they going to serve God? That's the question. And verses 3 through 6 are some of the most important verses in the Old Testament for understanding just what was supposed to be going on with Israel. So we can read that second part again. Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, all the way through 6.
You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians. Oh, sorry. Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my commandments, then you shall be my own possession.
So I remember there's someone who wrote a systematic theology, and he actually has a big section in it called Israelology. And you don't find many systematic theologies with that particular section, but it kind of makes sense to have it because, you know, so much of the Bible is devoted to the nation of Israel. And you might ask, do I have an Israelology? Do I understand what God was what God was doing with this nation? If you're going to have a good Israelology, you'd have to start here. And God is talking to Moses, and he's telling him to talk to Israel. And the first thing he does is summarize what happened with Israel with three statements. What are the three statements that he makes about what happened? And what is he talking about with each of those three statements? So give me one.
Bore you on eagle's wings.
Okay, yeah. So that would mostly probably describe their time in the wilderness. And we'll come back to that one. What else? What's another statement that he said there? That he says there? The first one.
You've seen what I did to the Egyptians.
Okay, so that's their rescue, really, how he defeated their enemies. How I bore you on eagle's wings, that's their rescue, their time in the wilderness. And then the third statement,
brought you to myself.
So let's think about those statements a little bit, especially starting with, I bore you on the wings of eagles. What's going on there? As you're reading, what is the author even trying to do? This is a good reading skill that I always have to like push myself. He's trying to get your mind to make a picture. So it doesn't do much good to read sentences like this if you don't get the picture, you know, if you just read over it. Otherwise, it's kind of wasted effort here. he's giving you a picture. It's an unusual picture. What's it a kind of a picture of? I mean, it's a picture of an eagle carrying a nation almost. Yeah. An
protection.
Eagle. Protection. Yes, exactly. And this is a picture that's going to come up later in the Bible. Can anybody think of a time eagle's wings, Israel, God comes up later in the Bible? There's one famous one that's a little different, but it's the same kind of picture. And then there's a less famous one that we'll actually talk about.
Isaiah.
Yeah, Isaiah chapter 40. Wings like eagles later in Isaiah 40. But actually, another time that this is used is by Moses as he is at the end. So this is at the beginning of his time with Israel, kind of. And towards the end, he writes a poem about his experience with Israel in Deuteronomy 32. So just turn to Deuteronomy 32 for a second. We'll come back here, but Deuteronomy 32, 8 through 11. Someone read Deuteronomy 32, 8 to 11. I'll stop you as we read, so don't be scared.
When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God.
Okay, so explain what's going on in that verse. This is, again, Israelology. What's that?
Where each people group. Like,
yeah, so it's picturing God as almost dividing the whole world up. Not almost. As God, as dividing the whole world up. He's the one who established the nations. And he put them where they are. Somehow having to do with, according to the number, your translation says the sons of God. There's another, the ESV. Or the New American Standard says sons of Israel. And that's because there's a little bit of a, they call it a textual variant. And so there's some manuscripts that would say sons of God. There are some manuscripts that would say sons of Israel. And that means you have to kind of make an interpretive decision. Like by sons of God, does he mean sons of Israel? Does he mean... there are some people who think what he means is actually like angels or demonic beings. And so that the idea is that like there are angels that he gave authority over different nations to. He had so many nations and he kind of gave the authority over those nations to those angels. But there's a lot more evidence that it is sons of Israel than there is that it is sons of God. So... many more manuscripts and better manuscripts say sons of Israel. And so basically what he's saying is that he put the nations where they are, somehow having to do with the size of Israel, what he wanted to do with Israel. And then he goes on. Why did he do that? This is verses 9 through 11, I guess.
But the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob his allotted heritage. He found him in a desert land and in the howling waste of the wilderness. He encircled him. He cared for him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, catching them, bearing them on its pinions. The Lord alone guided him. No foreign god was with him.
Yeah, and so it's like out of all the nations, God is choosing Israel, and he's saving them and he's caring for them all by himself. This is all God. And the question is, why is God doing that? Why is God choosing this nation? And if we go back to Exodus, the last part of the statement is pretty beautiful. He says he's doing this to bring them to himself. He rescued them from Egypt. He cared for them, chose them, and brought them to this mountain because he wants to have a relationship with them. And even this statement here that he brought them to himself is really it's like, if you put it in its context in the ancient world, it's really a surprising, it's like super unique for God. For this is, again, you know, somebody was talking about the trustworthiness of the Bible on Sunday to me, asking me about the trustworthiness of the Bible. And there's lots of proofs of the trustworthiness of the Bible. But one of the demonstrations of the trustworthiness of the Bible is just how different it is than all the books around it, all the man-made ideas that surround it. So culturally, in Moses' day, the way that it worked with people did have gods, obviously, but the way that it worked with those gods that they had was that the gods were like tied to the land. So Marduk didn't really give a rip who lived in Babylon. All he cared about was Babylon. So you could put different people in the city of Babylon and Marduk would still be their god. That may even be what Naaman was, it may be what Naaman was thinking when he brought the land of Israel. You know, he wanted dirt to take back with him to where he was from. It might be that he still was a little confused about how Yahweh worked, because that's how people in that day thought. But here we see that the relationship between Yahweh and Israel is very different, because they're not even in the promised land yet. So it's not so much about Yahweh's commitment to this little piece of dirt as much as it is his commitment to these people. He wants to have a relationship with these people. And this is important too, because we haven't even gotten to the law yet. And so before God talks about what he wants Israel to do, he's talking about bringing Israel to himself. And so that is what happened. Now, why? Why? It's somehow connected back to the Abrahamic covenant, because what we're about to read is part of a whole story. So and the story begins with Abraham. Well, begins with the problem in the world and then Abraham. And so we know that God's doing something with the descendants of Abraham as part of his big plan to bring blessing to the nation. So he separates this one nation from the others to bring blessing to the nations. How? Well, first of all, he rescues them. He saves them. But then what does God want? What does he say? He says, I guess this is verses 4 through 6. Did we read that part yet? Mm-hmm. We read, if you will keep my covenant, if you will obey my covenant, have we read that?
Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant.
Yeah, let's read that again.
Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples for all the earth. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel.
Okay, so God wants them to obey his covenant. Now, what does that mean? The word obey, I saw someone recently who was writing, it actually would be better to say here, listen. So he's saying, if you will listen to my voice. What distinguishes Yahweh from other gods is that he speaks, and what distinguishes his people is that they listen. And then two, keep my covenant. So there you have the idea of obeying. And I like that phrase, my covenant. God's setting the terms here. And how does he do that? before he tells them what exactly they're supposed to do, he gives them a promise and he gives them an encouragement. If they keep his covenant, what is going to happen?
Be a treasured possession among all the peoples of the earth.
Yes. A kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And so what is a treasured possession? What's God saying there is going to happen to Israel if they obey God's covenant?
You're going to be my special people?
Yeah, so obviously treasured. But what's that telling us about? What are some things that's telling us about the nature of their relationship? I mean, just those two words, treasured possession.
They'll be unique.
They'll be unique, dearly loved, and possession.
You don't belong to
me. Yeah, you belong to me, yeah. I was reading this week about the idea of grace, and I think that it, I'm still thinking through it some more, what he said, but it was... Yeah, it was kind of a thought that I hadn't had before in this way that is opening up some new things. I don't know. But he talks about grace as a gift, and he was saying that in our culture, we tend to think of the best gift as one that is undeserved and that has no strings attached. So we would say, you know, a totally perfect gift is one that I give to you and I don't have any expectation that it will impact our relationship as well. But this guy was saying that's kind of a, you know, different cultures think of gifts differently. And so he was just pushing back on that a little bit, that a gift can be gracious with expectations that it's going to transform the relationship. So it's not like a gift is not a great gift or a perfect gift or a totally undeserved gift if when I give it to you, I expect that it will impact our future relationship. So, I mean, lots of examples of that, but like if I give a homeless guy a house, it's not all of a sudden a work if I... You know, it doesn't change the graciousness of the gift if I expect that he'll live in the house after I give him the gift. You don't, if I give a homeless guy a gift with the expectation that he'll live in the house, you don't say to me, that was that's works now. He earned that gift. You would say, no, that's totally a gracious gift, but that gift has you expect that gift's going to transform his life. And so certainly we see here God is giving a massive gift to the Israelites, but it is a gift and it's all grace. You wouldn't say God's rescue of Israel wasn't gracious, but it has there are expectations that there's going to be a difference in the way that they exist. And actually, if they don't do it, it's going to have consequences. And that doesn't make it any less gracious from the beginning. So Israel's going to belong to God in a unique way. They're going to be a holy nation. What is that? What does a holy nation, what does a holy nation mean?
Set apart.
Yeah, so they belong to God and they're going to be set apart for God. And there's going to be this nation. They're going to be set apart, even we're going to see, Exodus 20, the way that they live, the way that they obey God. So the idea, in a sense, is that there's going to be this one nation on the planet that you could look to and see what it's like to live with God as king. And then a kingdom of priests. What's going on there? Because this is one of the most important for understanding Israel.
People who have the ability to go directly to God.
Okay, so that's going to be one thing, that they're going to have a unique relationship with God. They're not all going to be literal priests, though. Isn't that interesting? So he must be saying something, because they had a whole group of people that they were set apart even from Israel to serve by going into the temple. So kingdom of priests, what else could it mean? They're going to have a unique, they're going to be able to go to God. Priests don't just go to God, actually. What else do priests
make sacrifices for people?
Yeah, they serve the people. They represent God to the people. So this is how somebody puts it. As the priest represents the people before God and then represents God to the people, Israel is called to do the same. Israel is called to be a community of priests whose congregation is nothing less than the whole globe. The end of the covenant is not Israel's own salvation, but the inclusion of the nations, since all the earth belongs to God. The expression holy nation underscores the twofold character of Israel. It is set apart to God, and it is visible as such to the rest of the world. It is a holy life lived in community that will display God's name to the world. Israel will essentially be a shop window of God to the world. So it's, you know, how a shop window, the idea is you can walk by a shop window and you kind of see, they usually put stuff up in there so you can see what's in the store. And so in a sense, you can imagine the world walking by this little shop run by God, and Israel's the shop window. They can see, oh, well, that's what life is like lived in the presence of God, lived under the authority of God, and be drawn into the shop itself. And that's kind of neat to talk about, because we're not Israel as a church. That's a really important point. But Peter takes up this imagery in 1 Peter, doesn't he? And he applies it to us as the church and the role that we have now. And so one of the purposes of the church is to be a shop window to the world as well. Like, the world should be able to look at the church and see a different kind of life. And the way that we relate to one another, the culture that we have at the church, should be a picture of what it's like to live with Jesus as King. And so that's one of the challenges of being part of the church, is that, like, we are to live a different, to live a fundamentally different kind of life as a community, even. And that's difficult, because there's a lot of pressure on us to live according to the world system. So we have to help each other, and it's hard. I was thinking, even this is probably too much, but, like, even in the structures of our society, you know, a lot of the structures of the way life is built on selfish, based on a selfish worldly agenda, like normal life. And so it makes it even more challenging to live a different kind of life when the whole society is set up, in a sense, to make it difficult to live that kind of life. So one example of that is, like, we're supposed to live, you know, bearing one another's burdens. But the whole structure of American society feels like it's sort of set up for us to live on our own, with hardly anybody knowing that we have any burdens. So it really takes a kind of enormous effort to swim against the flow. And yet it's important that we try, because we want to be a shop window to the world. Not just like the world walking by and looking in. It's like, oh, that looks like every other shop on the road here. But they're supposed to look in and be like, oh, wow, that's a different, they're selling different things in there. And that's true not just in the church, but also in our marriages. And I mean, one of the things we talk about as a family is, like, you are going to be different if you're a Christian. Just get ready for it. You know, don't expect that the advice you're going to get is going to be the same advice that you're going to get from an unbeliever. And don't expect that your life is going to, the decisions that you're going to make are going to make sense to most unbelievers. But anyway, this is going to be the purpose. We're going to read a lot of laws, and some of them are going to be so confusing. But at the end of the day, it's important to remember, I might not get all this, but the purpose is to help Israel know how to image God to the world. Kind of like Adam was to be he's made in the image of God. He was to represent God. Israel now, in this fallen world, it has to be given all these laws so that they could make God known to the world. This guy puts it like this. He says, though God is invisible, he will be made visible through the actions of a people that are close to him. It's a neat line, isn't it? Though God is invisible, he will be made visible through the actions of a people that are close to him. So that's the purpose of Israel. And we're going to see the rest of the Old Testament is going to show us how they do at that. And also that will help us understand why God takes it so seriously, because it's not just about Israel. Like, they fail, it has an impact on the world.
Is it in a sense like him trying to have an image of like the Garden of Eden again, right? Because of the idea of like, you shall be the priest and holy nation.
For sure.
The idea of like Adam and Eve forfeiting that at the garden.
You're going to see that even bigger when we get to Leviticus. He even uses specific language about like, and that's why he said, I'm going to take out all your diseases if you obey me. Already he said that. He's kind of, in a sense, like it's going to be a reversal of the curse. You're going to be able to picture the Garden of Eden in a fallen world to draw people back. In Leviticus, he's going to say, if you'll do this, I'll walk with you, which is the same kind of language. That's used in the Garden of Eden. Yeah, so it's exciting. This is an exciting opportunity for Israel.
Yeah, it's cool how he also, before that, like reminds him of his faithfulness to his covenant.
Yes.
Like, I've kept my part.
Yes.
Right?
Totally.
I pulled you out of Egypt.
Yeah.
Like all that.
Yeah.
So here's my part of the covenant.
Yeah.
I need you guys to keep your part.
Yeah.
So that we can return back to what it's supposed to be like.
Yeah. And it's going to be pretty sad because we're going to see like, wow, man can't do it. A whole nation can't do it, even after all God's done for them. And hopefully by the end of the Old Testament, we're going to be like, we need a savior. But unfortunately, by the end of the Old Testament, the Pharisees were like, we just need to be better. And
so kind of crazy about it. It's kind of interesting here what God's offering them and how it is. It's kind of a way if they listen that they can have God's kingdom, but it's almost without suffering. Kind of.
Yeah.
Right?
And right.
Kind of thinking about how different it is for the Christian call to follow Christ.
Yeah.
And how that is only through suffering that we become, you know, that first his suffering, then we follow him. I don't know, it's just kind of really interesting. It's kind of like this great setup here. You can have all this without the way of the cross.
Right.
Kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But then we know, like, I started to think about it, I was like, well, there's all the sacrifices. But it's really different from like our call and
right, yeah.
The way that God ends up doing it.
Right. Yeah. It is interesting. Yeah. So God has told them their purpose. Now he's going to begin making a covenant. And what it's kind of interesting. In the ancient Near Eastern world, like they had ways that kings would. So say one big nation defeated another little nation. That big nation would make a treaty with that little nation. And they have examples of those kinds of treaties, and they're different forms of them and all that, but they follow a similar pattern. So there's like almost like a genre, a treaty genre, like where you're like, okay, that's obviously a treaty. Does this first, does this second, does this third. And you can compare some of those treaties to what happens in the next few chapters, and that's exactly, it follows that exact seven-step process of an ancient treaty. So here it's like God, the great king, is coming to meet with this servant that he's rescued, these people that he's rescued, and he's making a treaty with them. And it would start with, the process would start with getting the servant ready for the coming of the king, which is what happens next. And so we can read the next verse, I think. So Moses came.
So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together. We will do everything the Lord has said.
Okay, so we'll just stop there for a second, because that's pretty neat to hear Israel say that. And they're saying that before they get the laws. So they're not really, they're committing themselves to a person. They're committing themselves to God. Unfortunately, they don't last long, but they will take this moment. They say, we'll do everything that he says. And then what happens? Sorry, yeah, you can keep reading. Okay, so stop there for a second, because that's surprising a little bit. What is surprising about that statement?
Moses?
Yeah, I thought that was kind of surprising. It's not what I expected it to say. I thought it would say me, but it says you. So what is going on, do you think? Moses had rescued them, and what is Moses about to do in the rest of these chapters, you know, all the way to Deuteronomy? He's going to communicate God's law to them. So what does God want to make sure happens before that?
They trust him.
Yeah, that they recognize that Moses is speaking for God, and believing Moses, is, in a sense, their response to Moses and what he says is going to reveal their response to God, really. Moses is speaking for God now. So to believe Moses' words is to believe God. And so it's vital.
Apostles, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's almost like this is God authorizing Moses to be the person who mediates his revelation to his people. Now, for God to appear to his people, he has to get them ready. And so, what goes on next?
Verse 10?
Yeah, I think so. When Moses told the words of the people, basically.
The Lord also said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments, and let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people, and they washed their garments. He said to the people, be ready for the third day. Do not go near a woman.
Okay, yeah. Let's stop there, yeah. Marta, could you sit over there? So what's standing out here to you as you read that, as Isaiah likes to talk about the vibe? What is what's going on?
I'm going to take a wild guess based on one of the things Isaiah's mentioned is if you're in a section, if there's something beginning or ending the section, it's good to notice those. And one of the things he's saying is the third day twice at the beginning of the section and the third day at the end of the section.
Oh, yeah. So that's just even interesting, isn't it, that this emphasis on the third day, and that's going to keep on going. And again, when you're reading the Bible, the whole Bible, it's almost like listening to a long symphony. And so in a long symphony, I'm not very musical, so I'm making stuff up here, but let's just imagine this is how music works. That there might be a note that the guy puts in there at the beginning that's really loud, and it's played in different settings. But later on, someone that's really good, the symphony's been going on for an hour, they might hear that note again towards the end, and somehow you're getting into, it's like, oh wow, that's familiar with what happened at the beginning. And so third day is definitely one of those notes in the Bible that's going to come up later. Something big is going to happen for God's people on the third day here. God is going to show up in a unique way. But what else? It's definitely intense. I mean, you see a cow wander over towards the mountain, like, no, no, you like kill that cow. You can imagine the moms with their kids that day. They're like, you guys are not playing outside the tent today. I'm watching you. There's a consecration that's going on, washing. There's limits. You have to put somebody to death if they do the wrong thing. There's even restrictions on normal marital relationships. So what do you think is the point of all that?
I think to get them ready to be before God, right? Because God's coming down and he's holy. So I think of Aaron, we were just teaching about that this last Sunday, right? And how God commanded Moses how to consecrate him, and part of it was being washed. And here we see just the idea of washing of your clothes, abstaining from sexual intercourse, I guess the last part. I'm just reading a little blueprint there. But yeah, like, don't go near women. But
yeah.
The idea of, like, making yourself, like, pure before I come into your presence.
Yeah, well, one of the things I love about the Old Testament that I almost have to shout out to myself when I read this or whenever I read the Bible is that it's reminding us that God is not just an idea. So this is not just like a concept. Like, why do they have to do all of this? It's because God is not just an idea. Like, you don't have to do all this before you, like, listen to a lecture on quantum physics. You know, like, this is a person who is approaching another group of people. And so if this were a human king who were coming to meet with his people to make a treaty, what would happen? They would probably have to do a lot of these things if a human king were coming. And what would happen if you had 600,000 people and someone broke through the crowd to run up to that human king? Yeah, he probably would be, even today, you know, you'd have security guards jumping out, tackling him. And if he kept going, he would probably, yeah, it would be serious. There would be something serious that happens. And so God is making clear to his people and to us that, like, no, God is not just an idea. Like, the goal, the long-term goal is for us not just to be sitting around talking about an idea for eternity. We're going to be having a relationship with a real person who exists and who is awesome and glorious. And here, we're just getting a little, in history, snapshot of God preparing his people for his arrival. And then what happens when he arrives? We'll just close by reading this part.
Oh, that's funny. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up.
I finish this off here.
And the Lord said to Moses, go down and warn the people, lest they break loose to the Lord, to look, and many of them perish. Also, let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. And Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you yourself warned us, saying, set limits around the mountain and consecrate it. And the Lord said to him, go down and come up, bringing Aaron with you. But do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and told them.
So what do you think all this says about God? What stands out to you as you look and read that?
I
one thing is that he's awesome. One thing that stands out to me as well is just thinking about Jesus. Like, if this is what happens to a mountain when God comes down, what a shock to see Jesus as a, you know, as a human, just a humble human baby even. Makes the transfiguration just an awesome moment, because at the transfiguration, it's like Jesus peels back the curtain. It's like, whoa, you get a little Mount Sinai picture of glory there, and it's back. It's back to. It's awesome that God is there. You know, it reminds me of that story with Aslan and the lion. If you've read the Chronicles of Narnia, and one of the children is scared to get close to Aslan, and she's like, "Are you a safe lion?" I'm totally messing it up. This is why pastors write stuff down, not make up illustrations. But she's like, he's like, "No, I'm not a safe lion," you know. And God is not safe in a sense. He's glorious and good, but he's not safe. Interesting here to think about the fact that he talks about priests. So if you're just reading the Bible and you're you don't want to get, this is a good illustration of where you don't want to get so lost that you miss the main point. But it is kind of funny that Moses talks about priests before we've had Leviticus. So it might be, you don't want to waste your whole time trying to figure out how does that work. But it's an illustration of something that you're like, oh, I wonder what's going on there. But it doesn't surprise you too much that, like, there was a priest of Midian, Jethro. They had been in Egypt for 400 years. They were religious people. So it wouldn't surprise you if they had some sort of structure set up with priests who were not necessarily functioning as God would want them to function. But here they've been rescued. They've only 3 months out of Egypt. It's not shocking that they have religious leaders that might be called priests, that Moses is going to have to fix the whole system in the next few books, but God is working within that system here before he gives them their laws and their regulations. So that's not too shocking.
Also, just like God wants to be worshipped a certain way, right? Like, he's a God of order. So, like, if you don't do it, I will kill you.
Yeah.
In essence, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Also, a good reminder that we're going to need help if we're going to live in the God, presence of God forever and not die. So I know sometimes after the Garden of Eden, I wish that I could see God and live with God the way that we were supposed to. And that longing is normal. But at the same time, if we don't have resurrected bodies and Jesus doesn't deal with the whole problem and God did that, we would all die. So the fact that we're not, you know, living and seeing that glory the way that we wish is actually part of God's mercy to us, because we wouldn't be able to live up on Mount Sinai and not be consumed until, I mean, it's part of why Jesus had to come. Yeah, somehow God, and even then, yeah. God had to set, he had to do it a certain way. Yeah. You know, he couldn't see God's face. And then when he did come down, Moses, you remember Moses' face, what it's going to look like? It, like, had a physical effect on Moses. The glowing man, they used to call him. And they didn't call him that. I made that up.
Heaven, it's a need to look for Moses.
Yeah.
Ask, how's that experience?
Yes, oh, my word.
You
can
talk to the Lord.
Oh, my word.
You're going to bring Aaron?
Yeah.
So Aaron, how you feel? Well, Moses thought you were going to come up with me.
Like, what? Yeah. Right. Like, no, I got stomachache. COVID. Sorry, I can't come out of my tent today. Yeah, I need the mask. Oh, that's for sure.
Funny, because Moses used to be so scared, like, he needed Aaron to
Yes, yeah, God is, and that's part of what happened there in Egypt is God transformed Moses too. All right, well, thanks, guys. Great to be together and great to think about God's word as a family.